Did your husband ever march with you in the parade?
No, no, no. Never had anything to do with it at all.
Because I know that there were men suffering.
Oh, yes, there were. I knew one of them, Witter Binner, who was a poet, was one of the very earliest. I think there were about 100 marched in the parade the year I went down from college to march in it, and I thought, I have since thought, to a few braver men.
But he was not anti-suffrage.
No, just more or less indifferent to it.
There's
turned up all kinds of effective slogans.
Were there particular people who seemed to dream up some of these things, like with the boats and the horses?
Well, I don't remember who was responsible for these ideas, but they were, of course, always trying to think of ideas that would get us publicity. And there were some women reporters who were very helpful to us, who tried to get us all the publicity they legitimately could. But, of course, they didn't mind how ridiculous the thing was. Mrs. Blatch's whole idea was, you must keep suffrage every minute before the public, so they're used to the idea, they talk about it, whether they agree or disagree. It must be something that everybody's conscious of. I think she was quite right.
Now, when you went on the street corners, you actually had your own little box that you would set down?
Yes, mm-hmm. They were little soap boxes, we used to call them. I don't know whether that's where the occasion, whether that's where it originated, but they were known among us as soap boxes, and each of them had a heavy handle on one end, which you carried the thing by, you got to the corner. And of course, sometimes, depending on the neighborhood, those were rather dangerous little things were thrown down from roofs, and sometimes stones were thrown into the crowd. I don't remember anybody actually being seriously injured, but they weren't fun.
But there'd be more than one of you usually going to one of these street speaking engagements.
Well, because there would be one always giving out pamphlets and things of that kind. Yes, as I recall it, there were always two.
Must have been quite unusual for women in those days to be speaking out on the street like that.
Oh, yes, of course. It was considered outrageous by many people.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you went into the advertising work at Macy's, did you continue the suffrage work at all?
I made speeches occasionally, but that was all.
But
I
you
was
no
pretty busy.
Coordinating the speakers bureau?
No, Macy, no. That was a full-time job.
And then you stayed at Macy's for how long?
Oh, I think about 6 months, and then I got pregnant. So I was then out of business until I think my daughter was about we were living in East Orange. I think my daughter was about 2 and a half, maybe. And I remember very well the day my sister said to me, fixing upon me a beady eye, when are you getting back to business? And I, of course, looked mildly surprised, to say the least, and said, well, how can I? She said, well, you should manage. And presently, there became vacant an apartment right across the hall from the place where she was living with my mother and sister. And she immediately said, now, this is the opportunity. Move back here, and then mother can help, and it'll be much easier for you to get a maid, so forth and so on. So that's what we did.
How did your husband feel about your career and your working?
Yeah. Well, that was him. So, that's where I started. But when I went back, then as I say, that's when I started to work for Macy, was then. No, that was when I decided I didn't want to go back to the department store field. I tried them first, and I said I wouldn't work after 3 o'clock in the afternoon because that's when the baby came home from the park. Oh, well, they couldn't hear of that. They could have hours off in the middle of the day, said one of them, who would like to have had me. But you've got to be here to sign out with the rest of the employees and sign in. And I said, well, I'm doing. So then I began on the agencies again. And by then, of course, I had a lot of good copy samples. Also, I didn't any longer look like Sis Hopkins. And most of them would hear nothing about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That was out. I got to one agency called the Federal Agency. It had nothing to do with the federal government. It had been named after the building that they happened to be in. And they had started out basically as a trade agency and were developing in the consumer field, and they'd never had women except as fire clerks or typists or something. So when I said this about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he considered it a while, and he said, well, never had a woman on the staff, I might as well try it, I like your coffee. So I was taken on to work only until 3. And after I'd been there some 30 years, and they were giving me a testimonial, one of the vice presidents stood up and said, well, I discovered the other day in the records of the accounting department that you were hired on a temporary basis, and I would like to suggest that you put on permanent payroll. And up until the war, World War II, I never did work after 3 o'clock in the afternoon because I enjoyed it. By condensing my lunch hour, I could always go to matinees and do all kinds of things. It was very pleasant. But then when personnel problems grew so difficult in World War II, then of course I was working till all hours myself.
Now, did you remain one of the few women writing copy in the agency for quite a long time?
No. After a relatively short time at copywriting, I was made what they call an account executive and did some copy still, but edited, of course, other people's copy. And then, of course, eventually I was made a vice president and the head of the department, mostly handling women's things, but not entirely. And I was extraordinarily fortunate. I sometimes think I worked for the only advertising agency I ever could have worked for because I did have complete authority. The president discovered, after a few years, if you just let me alone, I would make money for him. And so he did exactly that. And I was responsible to no one but my clients, really. I sent him memos about what we had decided to do, consult him in advance. And as I discovered in the course of my life, there were practically no other women in the advertising business who had any such degree of authority. In the big agencies, for instance, one or two who flirted with me later on, I discovered that everything was a la committee. It went up here and had to be approved, went up here and had to be approved. Well, I couldn't possibly have worked that way. I discussed things with my clients and came back and dictated the work reports and so forth and so on, and got their okays on the estimates, and that was it. I wasn't discussing it with anybody except occasionally with the research department or something of that kind, which was very unusual, I must say. I began to appreciate how unusual it was because sometimes my clients were the bosses of the women who were supposed to be having authority, and I, of course, knew from my work with their bosses that they didn't. That was particularly true, I think, of the women in the fashion group who were always supposed to be, so to speak, heads of these in the manual of their own particular departments, but I discovered in working with them that they, all of the things that they did had to be okayed, and I grew gradually to realize how unusual my opportunity was. So I was never tempted. I became a stockholder eventually and so forth. I was never tempted, really, to go to another agency.
So you stayed in that agency until you retired?
Mm-hmm.
I see. Were other women brought in?
Oh, yes. Eventually we had plenty of other women. I had several assistants and also women in other departments like research and art and so forth who were assigned to my accounts.
Did you continue your suffrage speaking and write it up until the passage of the Federal Amendment then?
No. I took time off, I think, for 2 weeks. Just before the final campaign, and put my small daughter in a small hospital where I knew the head of the hospital so that she would be properly looked after, so that I would be absolutely free all the time. I won't just leave her with a maid. And I spoke continuously for the last 2 weeks. before in the final campaigning. But before that, I had just spoken occasionally when they needed a speaker, especially in the evening.
Was this the campaigning prior to the passage of the amendment or during the ratification drive?
No, it was... Now, let me be sure about this, because, of course, New York had not ratified it. I wonder if that wasn't when we were working on New York to ratify it and lost. But I must have worked both times then, because I do remember that there was a vast celebration when we finally had it approved. Tennessee, I think, was the last one. But that spread over a long period of time, and my daughter would have been 5 when that happened, and she was much younger than that when I took this time off, so I think it must have been when we were trying to get it ratified in New York State. And I well remember, yes, I'm sure it was that, because I well remember the attitude of men, both in my office and in the subway and on the street, the morning after it was defeated in New York State. They openly jeered us.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you have, when it was known in your office that you were a suffragist, did you have difficulties before that?
No.
But once it had been given public approval for defeat, then it was all right too.
Oh, yes. No, nobody. I'd never had any discussion with them that I recall before, but there were 2 or 3 men in my office who took occasion to make disparaging remarks the morning afterwards. Well, I guess you know what we did to you yesterday, that kind of thing, you see. But it was a very passing phase.
Now, how did you... So you did keep some sort of active ties.
Oh, yes, because my sister was still, of course, vice president of the organization.
Now, did your sister pursue a career, or was she...
Oh, yes, and such a career in Wall Street. You have a very long one. She didn't retire from Wall Street. She still had her own clients in a brokerage house until she was 84. She's now 88.
Is she in California, too, or
she... No, she's down in Florida with... She broke her hip just as she was getting ready to come north something over a year ago and has never been able to. I went down to see her in July. She's in a wheelchair and very active mentally. Flies around in a wheelchair, but she will have to stay there the rest of her life. She's in a convalescent center in Vero Beach. Do it for you. She's terribly busy doing her own things. And I also felt when I was there in July that her memory for old time things had failed very badly. That was my impression. I felt that about family things, and I would suspect the same thing would be true about suffrage. I doubt she could give us any details anymore.
Do you recall your own reactions when Alice Paul and her group started their campaign in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I don't ever remember being disapproving because I understood quite well the reasons why she did it. But I remember being very horrified at what was done to the women, especially to this very delightful woman from... I think it was from Chautauqua County, whom I had enlisted in suffrage and who was one of the hunger strikers. And I think everybody was just sort of nauseated over the whole thing. It was so horrible. But I don't ever remember disapproving of it, except that I thought it was a dreadful thing for the women to go through. But I also felt that it was a very daring and probably a very valuable demonstration. But I did find, I have to admit, I found many of the things that were said by the English women who visited us, and I just was quite skeptical about it. This little group represented by Ms. Forbes Robertson and various others all belonged at that time to a, well, let's see, how shall I describe them? I guess perhaps they would say that they believed in free love, and there was a great deal of talk about people coming together only when they felt like making love, and having no family status, and children, if any, would have hyphenated names, and so forth and so on. And I was a little more conservative about things of that kind. I felt the family had a place in society, and I didn't go along with that. In fact, I used to think it rather funny. But they took it all very, very seriously. As you know, there was a whole cult of that sort of thing, especially in England. I think not to any great extent here. I did meet a few women in Greenwich Village at that time, whom my sister knew, who were living with men without being married to them, and, you know, there was a certain amount of talk about it, but they were still very valuable suffragists. But it was no, how shall I say, they weren't making much propaganda about it, as the English women were.
Mm. And so those were the women, for instance, the ones who we would identify as the Greenwich Village feminists, like Henrietta Rodman and those
yeah.
women.
Mm-hmm.
Were these women known to you in terms of their ideas, or was it primarily through your sister that you knew about these women?
I think I met most of them, but they were all somewhat older. They were basically friends of my sister's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So she was somewhat on the fringes of what was actually the feminist movement.
Oh, very definitely. I would say that I would always have called her a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
One of the very odd things is that along about middle age, she almost completely reversed these ideas.
Oh, really?
I consider her distinctly reactionary now. Have for many, many years.
Did you understand why the switch occurred?
No. Except I think she fell in love with the wrong man.
So she really made a complete turnabout in a lot of her ideas?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Many ways. Or at least, as far as what she thinks in her innermost mind, I don't know. But, at least in her expressions of opinion, I felt that she had changed very much. I wouldn't consider her even a liberal anymore, I haven't for many years.
Hmm. That's the kinds of things that we have found with several women.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Were involved early, primarily, very often, only because they felt it was a basic right,
mm-hmm.
but didn't have a broader political conception.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the change to other things seemed to have been very easy for many of them. Did once, after the passage of the amendment and once Alice Paul's group started on the Equal Rights Amendment, were you at all interested or involved in that campaign?
Not involved at all. No, by then I was already in the advertising business, very busy, child, so forth. No, I had nothing whatever to do with that, beyond being interested, of course, in what I read.
So after the actual ratification drive, you pretty much...
Nothing whatever.
Mm-hmm. Now, did the Women's Political Union survive after the drive? And
well, if it did, I don't have any recollection of it. Of course, after I fussed with Mrs. Blatch and departed from them and went into business, I no longer was as close to them, organizationally speaking. I spoke occasionally for them and they wanted me to be a speaker. But I don't remember that. I can't imagine that they would have stayed as an organization because there wouldn't have been anything for them to do, if you want to put it that way. At that time, I think it hadn't occurred to a great many women that once they got the vote, the rest wouldn't be easy. And I think most bosses, most men felt that. I remember once when watching at the polls, I was talking to a Tammany boss who was also walking, and he said, of course I'm opposed to women's suffrage. Once women get the vote, they can get anything else they really want. And that was more or less the attitude. It didn't, I think, occur to them that women were going to break up as soon as the vote was won. They let their organizations go, and most of them paid no further attention. A very few of them, of course, began to work in politics. But I think there were few and far between, from what I know at least.
Yes, the information that I have read was that up until about 1925, the politicians still thought there was a woman's block. And after that, it became obvious there was not. And he just really paid no heed to any legislation that the women were interested in. Was there any ties between the suffragists you knew and the early birth control movement?
Yes. Margaret Sanger, who was quite a good friend of my sister's, and who started those clinics in New York. They were periodically closed up by the police and reopened and argued over and so forth.
Now, would the women in the Women's Political Union, for instance, outright support that, which was still quite illegal? Or?
Well, I think that would have been entirely an individual affair. I know many of them were very interested and admired Mrs. Sanger very much, but I'm very, very sure that the Women's Political Union never, I don't ever remember its endorsing anything outside of its own interests. I don't think they could have. The women in it were much too diverse. There were women who believed all kinds of things. The only thing you might say that they all believed was that women ought to have the vote.
And also in somewhat in more militant
tactics
as well.
Yes, that's right.
Because
I wouldn't think they could be. Well, and there would have been such a risk of antagonizing those who didn't agree at all. We had all faiths and all types of people who worked for suffrage. Most diverse. In fact, for me, it was a liberal education, the kind of people I'd never come in contact with before, and some of them were most admirable. Every once in a while, it provoked some funny things. The daughter of Robert Ingersoll had a house in Gramercy Park, and they used often to have little committee meetings there, and among others, one of the best workers in certain districts was a young Jewish girl from Russia, as I recall it. And she attended a meeting one evening and took off her coat and gave it to the butler. And then she said, "Where is my check?" And the butler said haughtily, "It won't be necessary, madam." And of course, that little story went all around with great entertainment. But it's a very good example of the complete cross-section that we had in the suffrage movement. And I must truthfully say that I never saw any hint of snobbishness. There may have been some here and there, but it seemed to me that we all worked together for this one thing without regard. And I was, for instance, assigned to make a campaign of speeches in the section that was run by this same little girl. And I went and did exactly what she asked me, and she said very approvingly, "Well," she said, "it's nice to know you really took orders." And I said, "Well, of course, I came over here with my assignment to do just what you wanted done in this area." So evidently she hadn't counted others who hadn't been quite so cooperative. But on the whole, I do think that all kinds and conditions of women work together for suffrage. Great unanimity on the whole.
Was there, in effect, a sort of sisterhood of women as a result of the common?
Well, within the organization, because of course I suppose I knew as many women who didn't believe in suffrage as who did. You know, there were an awful lot who violently disapproved. But certainly there was a great feeling of cooperation and admiration among the women who worked together.
Mm-hmm. What would be the reactions of friends of yours who were not involved in the suffrage?
Well, I just thought it was a lot of nonsense.
Were they actively?
I've never known. I didn't happen to number among my friends any ardent anti-suffragists who did anything about it. Most of them were just plain indifferent. She thought it was a great waste of time, that it would just all be the same. They were, you know, oddly enough, they anticipated what really happened, what most of my friends said. This isn't going to make any difference. They're all going to vote the way their fathers and their husbands do anyway. You see, that was the burden of their song. And as it happened, that's just about the way it turned out, unhappily.
If the women in the Women's Political Union used the argument of the moral superiority of women, which a lot of the suffragists used?
Well, I don't remember that. Of course, I don't know what all the individual women did in their speeches. I don't remember that being borne down on much. I remember having a great argument following the same meeting at which I was supposed to write up the workers' meeting. I went home with a woman who had been a friend of my sister's and who was much more radical than I, and we fell into a discussion of the single standard. And I remembered very well, because I was a little shocked at the time, she said, well, if we ever do get to have a single standard, it'll be the men's standard and not ours. She spoke from experience in the news. She was a newspaper woman, and I don't remember that's being borne down on especially. In the first place, of course, we had this little ultra-radical group within the movement. I think it would have been a rather difficult argument to sustain.
Right.
I certainly never used it in speeches, and I don't know whether other women did or not.
Because I know in some groups the argument seemed to have been that women should have the vote because it would clean up politics and because they were, you know, morally on a higher plane and because there would be no more wars.
Well, perhaps some of them really thought that. I used often to bear down on what I still believe, that there were certain things affected by politics about which men were relatively unfit to judge, such as things that concerned children, schools, similar things, that I felt women should have a much larger voice in controlling. And that there were just naturally a whole lot of facets. I remember once going to make a speech somewhere, and on the way up in the train, the idea occurred to me, and I used it. I just picked up a copy of the evening paper and held it up in front of them and took one headline after another and showed how the thing talked about in that headline applied to women and went all the way across the front page. There wasn't a single thing in the news in which women didn't have a stake. And that was the thing we tried to get over.
Was the attempt primarily to convince the men directly or to have women work on men they know?
Well, of course, they were supposed to do both. No, the speaking that I had most to do with was general speaking, was with the idea of reaching as many people as you could. And of course, there would always be a few then who would want to really do something for suffrage, and they could join any organization they wanted to. I doubt very much that there was anything that you could call a uniform policy. There was too much diversity in the women involved. I don't think you could have.
So within the Speakers Bureau, for instance, you were concerned primarily with training women in terms of delivery rather than giving them ideas.
Mm-hmm. Of course, naturally, there were a few ideas that we talked about. Well, we find this is a good way to say this, and this pamphlet will be useful for this, that, and the other thing, you see. But no, basically, my job was to show them how to speak more effectively and to assign them to certain places that we needed speakers.
Mm-hmm. So then you, in about 1918 or so, then went full-time into the advertising work.
I went in the week that we went into the war in 1917.
And when did you retire?
I retired twice. I retired finally in 1958. I retired first and stayed home for years and was very bored. And then I went back in and stayed until my husband retired, which was 1958.
On And then it was shortly after that that you moved to California.
No, we went abroad for a year and went to Mexico the first year. No, we came to California when the Mount San Antonio Gardens opened, which was in September of 1961.
And you stayed with the same advertising firm throughout your career?
No, the second time. I had no idea of going back in when I retired. I was worn out with the whole advertising business. And I stayed home, I guess, 5 or 6 years. And one day, one of my old clients, one of my smaller clients, as a matter of fact, called me up. He'd been bitterly unhappy with his agencies ever since I retired, and asked if I would meet him at the Union League Club. He wanted to talk to me about something. So I went, and he had his general manager and so forth there. And he said, "Now, I'm about to go to Europe on a buying trip, and you can think about it while I'm gone. But I wish that you'd go to a small agency, anyone you pick, and make with them an arrangement to work only when you want to and as much as you want to, and take my account to them." So I thought about it. I had been fairly bored meantime, I may say. And so I did just that. And I didn't go in at all in the months of July and August. We had a place out in the country. And I worked, I think, about 3 days a week the other months, perhaps 4 or 5 hours a day, whatever was necessary to handle his account, basically. And I did some other things for them. Mm-hmm. But that was for 4 years, and then my husband was ready to retire, and so I quit too.
And did you have any other children? You had just the one child?
No, just one daughter.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you think in terms of specific points in your life that I should know to be able to get into in more detail that we haven't covered perhaps?
Well, I don't know that I can give you very much more detail. As you can see, it was the active work in suffrage was compressed into a relatively short time, and mostly what I knew after that is what I knew through my sister and through a somewhat detached interest in it. So I say I made them occasional speeches and things like that.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the suffrage club at Cornell that you started?
Well, I don't know whether it was my idea or whether my sister asked me to do it. But I just called and put up a notice, I suppose, or something. I didn't live in the dormitory. I lived at home. And called a meeting in our general auditorium, explained to them about the suffrage movement. I think it was after I'd been down to march in the parade, probably.
How many women
should represent? Well, Cornell at that time had only about 300 women and some 4,000 men. I should say we had a pretty big club before we got through. I should guess, and of course it went on after I left, I should guess that we must have had at least 75 members, perhaps, something like that. It was fairly popular with the women.
What sort of activities did the club engage in then?
Mostly talk.
Among themselves?
Mm-hmm. Except for this one occasion, which I told you, when we staged a debate.
Was there any connection between the college club and any suffrage group of women in the town itself?
No, not that I recall. This was not the woman that I had asked to debate. That's not a head of the suffrage group. She's the head of the women's club in Ithaca. No, I don't recall there was any special connection. The contrary to the way it really is here in Claremont, the town and gown were very separate in Ithaca. They had a town and gown club to which a few men and women from the city joined in with faculty, but basically the university was up on the hill and the town was down in the valley, and they had not too much to do with each other.
Do you recall there being a suffrage group in the town?
Oddly enough, I don't. I think the women's club may have been vaguely interested, but I don't remember, because I'm sure if there had been a suffrage society, I would have been the head of that that I would have asked, instead of the president of the women's club. No, you see, that was fairly early in the suffrage movement, but I think it must have been 1912. I surely don't think I started that my last half year. It must have been the year before, 1912, I guess it was, that I started the suffrage organization. And they hadn't, I don't know, of course, about Mrs. Katz's organization. I have no idea how widespread suffrage organizations were. Mrs. Blatch had concentrated largely in and around New York City. I think that perhaps my endeavors were among the earlier ones to organize the counties. Certainly nobody had been in those counties before. I think that more work had been done up in Westchester and places like that, around nearer New York. But I think that perhaps mine was the first attempt to organize the western counties.
Now, were these basically farming communities?
No. They were small towns, manufacturing. Of course, lots of farming in between. You know, in those days, the population was much, much less than now. But mostly they were small towns with a factory, let's say, or some kind of a business thing in which the people worked. Like Jamestown and Silver Creek and places like that.
It sounds like from the speech that you mentioned in this one place where you talked about unions, that you basically did speak to a working class.
Well, the people that you're apt to pick up in the street crowd are nearly all of them from that class, except for a few others that may be really interested in suffrage or just might happen to be roaming around the street.
So did you make an effort to try and reach, say, the middle class?
Oh, that I was the whole object of leaving behind a definite organization affiliated, in other words, a chapter of the Women's Political Union. It was up to them, then, to do the local work on all classes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, usually the names of the people whom we had as sympathizers were definitely middle class or upper middle class. They were people who had traveled and for some reason or other had been expressed some interest in suffrage. I don't recall any laboring class women who were ever on that list. They were, and of course, that was very fortunate for us. We were trying to reach the leaders, the local leaders in organizations in small towns, and let them then conduct the local organization work. It was called an organizing trip, and that's just what it was.
Were you fairly successful in each of these towns? Or?
Yes, I would think we'd say so. We left behind usually a rather good nucleus of women who would then start in to plan and to work actively, do things themselves. Oh, yes, it bore fruit, definitely. And, of course, it gave the central organization then a chapter with which to work directly, make suggestions to, and the chapter to ask questions and get materials from us. Well, it's just the way a political organization would work.
Now, you mentioned that you had a banner on the car.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall what the banner would say?
It was just an enormous, I was trying to remember its proper colors, because we used to explain what each color stood for, and I do remember purple stood for...
Oh, was it that purple, gold, and white?
Yes, that's right.
Do you remember what those colors stood for?
Yes, the white was for purity, of course, in those days. And the green was for courage, and the purple was for justice. That was supposed to be the explanation that we gave. Mm-hmm. Isn't it funny, this morning I could not remember what the third color was. I remembered the purple and white. Now I know it was the green.
And the banner was just alongside the car?
No, it covered, it was a big one, and it covered the whole back of the car when the, you know how the old-fashioned cars, the back went down in little layers of stuff across, and this would cover practically the entire back.
Oh, I see.
So it made a very effective device for public speaking.
But you didn't have any votes for women banners?
I don't recall. We had, of course, lots of literature, but I don't recall any other banners. That's the one we carried with us just for this purpose. But of course, they had lots of those in the New York office, lots of votes for women and other types of placards that were carried in small demonstrations and things.
Because I vaguely recall the picture, now it may have been more than one occasion when one of these boats went up the river, but I do recall a picture of a boat with the Votes for Women banner alongside of it. Now that may have been an excursion that you went on.
Oh no, ours was a small motorboat containing about six terrified people. No, but they had all those other things. I don't doubt that they had demonstrations. In those days, they had what they called Fall River boats, which went up the Hudson from New York to Albany. And I'm sure they must at some time or another had one. And, wherever they were having county fairs or things of that kind, there would be a booth and people speaking, handing out literature, banners, of course, such things.
Did this motorboat you were on have any signs at all?
No, much too small. It was just a little, I would guess probably it was 10 or 15 feet long. It was a very small motorboat.
Yeah. And did you have megaphones then?
Yes, the yelling was done through megaphones. Yes, I inquired a good many four-letter words on the boat trip.
How long did the trip last, do you recall?
Oh, 2 or 3 hours. We were all exhausted, thought we were going to be submerged. And a group of men who were going on a fishing trip, they thought that it was funny to annoy us. They went around us in circles and leaving each time a tremendous wave behind them until they almost swamped us. And then they decided maybe that was a little too much, and they went away. Oh, yes, there were lots of things like that. Well, I doubt that I can tell you anything much more because, as I say, the actual association with the organization was of relatively short duration, less than a year probably. While I continued to be interested and make occasional speeches, I was much too busy.
Anita, that's a terrace.
Oh, good, because usually what I do...
She's a Bostonian, and she may or may not be willing to cooperate. So don't be surprised if you get put off. But she told me a considerable pride that she had walked.
Oh.
Suffered for it in Boston, so I think she might be.
Because usually what I do is send out the flyer, which explains the project, there have been very few women who have really not wanted to...
And I don't know how much she knows, but she did a lot of things. For instance, she was a fire warden during the stay, and she's a little mite of a person.
Oh.
Very, very proper. Very formal in many ways. But awfully nice. I'm very fond of her. But whether she would or wouldn't.